720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. Always grateful to you for doing that. Lots to do on the show today, the last show of mine anyway for 2018. We're going to start all again and keep this fun rolling into 2019, that's for sure. So first up, we are talking with Meredith Kolodner. She is an education reporter at the Hechinger Report, and she has a piece in the New York Times that you might have seen. It's very interesting. It is all about for-profit cosmetology schools, and that is not a topic we talk about very much on this program, but it is a really, really interesting one. These schools are incredibly costly, at least some of them anyway. Anyway, and very demanding, but there's some questions around the business model and what it really does in terms of fulfilling the educational needs of its students and what happens to its students after graduation. Meredith, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
So talk us through this story, because, you know, I think we just think about any kind of school being pretty straightforward. You pay your tuition, you go, and then you have this education and off you go. But this story is really complex and interesting. And for those of you who follow me on social media, I'll be sure and share it after the program so you can read it for yourself. But talk us through a bit of this, Meredith, if you would.
Yeah. So, cosmetology school is, required for all, anyone who wants to get a license to practice cosmetology, which is haircutting, in some cases facials, and that sort of thing. So when you go and get your hair cut, the person who's cutting your hair is licensed. 80% of the cosmetology schools are for-profit schools, and most of them are privately held, so it's hard to get a sense of their profits, but there are some schools that have had to open up their books, and they're getting about $1.2 million to about $3.4 million in profits.
Interesting. So, but as you point out in the piece, there are, in fact, a couple of different revenue streams for these schools. It's not just about tuition. There's other things that are contributing to this number, this high margin of profit.
That's right. So the first stream of revenue comes from students, often close to 90% of it coming in the form of taxpayer grants. That's like a Pell Grant and also federal loans, and that pays for tuition. The second stream comes from the school salons. So you can go to a student salon and get a haircut or get your nails done for lower price, and that's how they attract clients. And the sales of the hair and beauty products, plus the salon work that the students do while they're in school, is revenue for the school. So if you're in school, if you're a student, you spend some time in classrooms learning about things like sanitation. But once you've hit a certain number of hours, you start working on real clients in the salons that are run by the schools. In most full-time programs, going to school is like a full-time job. It's different than going to other colleges. You clock in and you clock out for about 7 or 8 hour shifts. So it can be hard to hold another job so that the students can have income. The schools don't have to pay the students for doing the haircuts or doing the nails. In fact, the students are paying tuition for the hours that they work in those salons.
So they're not seeing any part of that.
Well, they don't have to be paid for that. Some individuals will give them a tip, and in some schools you're allowed to keep that tip, some schools not. So they get a little bit, but not anything substantial. And actually, the most recent school year that we have data for, the 2015-2016 school year, the for-profit cosmetology schools took in $200 million just from the revenue from their salons. So that's a significant amount that they're getting from the salons.
That's
a different business model, you know, than most colleges.
Right. That's a significant number on top of that margin of revenue from tuition. And so your story in particular, it starts here in the Midwest. Why did you pick this particular story to begin looking at this bigger story?
Yeah. So we sort of located the main part of it in Iowa, which has the highest number of hours in the country. Illinois is actually about 1,500, but Iowa has 2,100 hours. And we wanted to know why that was and who benefited and who lost from that high number. It's also among the states with the highest debt loads for students, as well as the highest tuition. So the average to go to school for just a little bit over a year full-time in Iowa is $20,000. And there's only one community college or public option in the state, which takes 2 years to get through. It is cheaper, but it's located in a really not very sort of a sparsely populated area in the northeast of the state. So it can be really tough for students to get to, especially because you have to pay transportation and all that sort of stuff.
Sure. And so you mentioned Iowa having this higher requirement for hours and Illinois much lower. Why is that? Why is there not, say, maybe a national level and say, okay, anyone who is cutting your hair, doing your nails, whatever, has this level of education? What is behind the variance of hour requirements there?
Yeah, so the average in the country is about 1,500. There are some states that have gone down to 1,000. In Iowa in particular, they have, it was sort of surprising, they have a very well-organized association of for-profit cosmetology schools. They have a lobbyist that they pay. They also have a political action committee, a PAC, they give money to candidates, and they have a lot of relationships with legislators. They've been around for a long time. So actually this year there was legislation introduced in both houses, so we were really interested to see how that was going to go. Both, your listeners might know, both the House and the State Senate is controlled by Republicans, as well as the governorship, and they introduced bills in both houses. But the schools and their lobbyists really mounted a very fierce pushback, and so the legislation was blocked by the schools, and it died in committee.
So I want to shift now to we've talked about this business model and this, like, how the school is set up. After graduation, this story takes a really, I think, a pretty stark turn here, because you think about, you get some education and you have this new skill set or this degree, and then off you go. But according to your reporting, it really it doesn't seem like quite so rosy. It seems like actually quite grim in terms of the wages attached to entry level positions in this industry and what workers are going through when they transition from this full time student role to full time worker with this significant debt.
Yeah, that's what makes it really tough. They graduate on average, like nationwide, you got about $17,000. In debts. The average charge is $17,000 for tuition. So if you imagine having to pay that over a year, and then the average income after you graduate is $25,000. And that can go on for a number of years. The places that are easiest to get a job are places like Great Clips or Sports Clips. And, they make about $10 an hour there. And, a certain number of people go to a fancier salon and that kind of thing, and they can make, up to $50,000. But that is really the minority of people who are able to get that kind of job. We talked to some people also who use the income-based repayment plan that the federal government allows. You can just pay $5 or $10 a month, which does make your monthly payments easier, but the interest builds on that. And we talked to one student who was working in Nebraska. Her name is Ashley, and she makes $10.50 at Great Clips. But she graduated 5 years ago, and because she can't pay very much each month, she started with student loans that were about $22,000, and they're now up to $29,000 because the interest has built, and she told us she thought she'd be paying off the debt for the rest of her life. She didn't have a lot of hope for how she was going to get rid of that debt.
Which is such a grim reality I know a lot of people are facing. And we have this conversation a lot, I think, around the four-year university, but I don't know that we're talking about this as much around a specific trade or skill or something like that. And so what hope is on the horizon here? Are we seeing groups doing anything? Are we seeing any kind of state-level or local organizing going on to try to shift this a bit?
Yeah, there are some local coalitions in states, and then there are also national coalitions. So some of the salons have gotten together to they have two points of view. Some of them think the hours should come down to 1,000. Some of them know that that's a real tough sell, and so they're looking for a nationwide limit of 1,500 hours, which would also allow the cosmetologists to go from state to state. So if they're not finding good jobs in Iowa, they could go to Illinois or someplace where they could make a better living. There have been actually some success in cosmetologist associations and even a couple of individual salon owners who feel like it's not right how much their students are graduating in terms of debt. There are about 11 states that have introduced bills to lower the number of hours. That's South Dakota and Montana got it down to 1,500, and Nebraska was very high, 2,300, I think. And they took years, actually. They had battles with the schools, but they did bring their requirement down to 1,800.
It's really interesting.
I mean, yeah, no, I think like New York and Massachusetts have 1,000 hours requirement, and especially the people we talk to in New York, there's really no evidence that, you know, if you only go to school 1,000 hours, that you make less money or anything like that, the less training. There is evidence that your debt is lower. And some of the folks we talked to in Iowa, they said, well, we're really, you know, we have a lot of rural areas, so we really need this many hours so that our students are fully, you know, fully trained, because they have to go maybe start their own salons in their town, so they want maximum education. But the folks we talked to in New York made the point that there really are a lot of rural areas there upstate, and it hasn't caused those problems for those graduates.
It is really kind of this, like a microcosm for some bigger social things that we're talking about right now with like student debt crisis and wage inequality. Like it really does kind of quickly bridge into other topics. Well, Meredith, I thank you so much for joining us today. Again, for those of you who...
Oh, thank you for having me.
Certainly.
Really appreciate it.
Those of you who follow me on social media, again, I'm going to be sure and tweet this story out so that you can read it for yourself. It is really, really interesting. So thanks again. And we'll talk to you next time, Meredith.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, so we are going to take a little break, and we'll come back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth.
I'm Griffin Filipich. Sorry to jump in.
Jump in.
I've been producing your show here. We did get a call during that last conversation with Meredith Kolodner.
Yeah.
About the cosmetology school, from someone who's worked in the field for...
Oh, really?
...three decades, and she was a little less convinced on... the predatory nature of these schools or something like that. She said the profession is entirely what you make it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And
I think that's kind of with anything. Yeah.
I think, it sounded like that could apply to most professions. But she was saying, well, of course, if you come out and work at Great Clips, you're not going to, you need to find a salon that will educate you.
Interesting.
Yeah. But isn't that the job of the schools to educate you? You know.
Yeah, I you know what, we ran out of time to talk about this, but I was curious about. I wanted to ask Meredith about salons that are particularly, or like schools that are attached to salons. Like for example, up in Lincoln Park, there's like the Aveda Salon and Training Facility. You know, so with the expectation you're learning the Aveda way of doing things, things like that. So I wonder about that. Well, I appreciate the call.
Yeah.
I think that's always really interesting when people call with kind of insider knowledge. That adds some extra layers to a story that we're talking about. Well, it's our last show of 2018 is what's going on. And so we're going to be looking on the other side of news at some of the biggest stories of 2018 in the business world. There's lots of them. I mean, most of the stories were political this year. Let's not kid ourselves. And many of the business stories veered into political stories. But nonetheless, we're going to be taking a look at that. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us here on this final business lunch of 2018 before we look into 2019 and all the marvelous business stories awaiting us in the new year, I'm sure. We're joined now by Lauren Zumbach, regular contributor to this program and business reporter at Chicago Tribune, who has written a couple of really interesting stories I wanted to be sure and talk about. Lauren, welcome back to the program. Always a joy to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So let us start by talking about the holiday shopping numbers as we're looking at them. You know, for the last few years, we've had some conversations about what online retail has done to the brick and mortar and things like that. And so kind of generally, what did this year look like shopping wise? And what does the post-holiday shop look like?
Yeah, so, you know, this year, I think going into the holiday season, a lot of people had really high expectations. People seemed to be in the mood to spend. And, you know, it's still pretty early. A lot of retailers haven't, you know, reported their financial results yet, but all the indications seem to be that that was very much the case. You know, MasterCard Spending Pulse, which tracks where people are spending in stores and online, said things overall, how spending during the holiday season was up about 5%, online up even more, about 19%. And according to their accounts, people spent more than $850 billion between November 1st and December 24th this year.
And then there's always that that second little bump there, kind of after Christmas and shortly into the new year, where I think people are, I think we're all very trained to look for sales and deals and that kind of thing, and these huge clearance things. And there seems to be kind of a second economic number right there in that period of time.
Right. And we're still kind of in the middle of that period. There's a one research firm in Chicago that actually was predicting that December 26th and December 29th were still going to be two of the busiest days in stores this holiday season, even though they're after most of the holidays are over and theoretically people have already given their gifts. And, you know, a lot of that, they said, is just the day after Christmas is always a big day for people to go back and, like you said, look for those sales, or, you know, when I was out talking to people on State Street, maybe buy some of the things they hoped to get seen under the tree but didn't actually find. And then the Saturday, the first Saturday after Christmas is usually a big spending day as well, you know, especially for people who, you know, were back in the office on that weekday after Christmas.
Right. And so when do we see this taper off right at the start of the new year, or does it roll into the new year by a few days?
You know, that's a good question. And actually, they didn't report on that specifically, but It sounded like things do taper off, reasonably quickly. So,
well, not for long. I was in my grocery store yesterday, and they were already putting all the Valentine's Day stuff out. So I was like, "Can you give us a minute?"
Oh, sure, Valentine's Day, yeah, New Year's resolutions.
That's so. Right. Can we have a minute with nothing? No,
never stop.
Never stops. So another story I want to talk with you about is really an interesting one, and that is, it's a wonderful headline. The headline is, "Why are paper Christmas cards still a thing? Millennials, for once, are to thank," which cracked me up. But it's a really interesting story about how younger people are really fueling and keeping the paper greeting card or holiday card alive.
I know. Of all the industries that millennials get accused of taking down, now this is one where they're actually getting some credit. And, you know, part of that is, you know, talking to people in the card industry, they'd said that, you know, sales of greeting cards had been declining for a number of years, but they've really been holding steady for the past five or six. And they credited that to almost a reaction to the fact that, you know, we spend so much of our time online and on social media and looking at our devices. So even though that gives us more ways to keep in touch than ever, you know, when people do want to, you know, maybe send those holiday season greetings, you know, they almost want something that's a little bit more tangible and shows that they really put thought into choosing something for a particular person, or, you know, has some keepsake value, like one of those paper cards.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this with a lot of industries, right? Where we saw this in publishing. As ebooks happened, suddenly publishers were putting out these kind of special limited edition, pretty embossed books. And we saw this in the music industry, where the more people were streaming music, suddenly, you know, producers were putting out like nice pressings of vinyl, and vinyl became a thing again. So this does not surprise me at all. I think there's like a craving for analog the more we go digital.
Right. And you're absolutely spot on with the trend toward more special products. You know, with holiday cards too, you know, just because people are buying paper cards again doesn't necessarily mean they're buying the same kinds of cards. You're seeing a lot of people take an interest in things that do feel a little bit more personal and, you know, chosen especially for someone, whether that's a card you can buy online that you can customize with, you know, a photo of yourself or your family or even your pet. That's one of the trends that people talked about. Or just getting a card that, Hallmark has introduced a line that they're sort of three-dimensional and they pop up. So something with a little bit of an extra, you know, that goes beyond just the basic card that you might have seen more of in past years.
Right. It seems like I feel like, just anecdotally, I feel like I saw less of the big box of here's, you know, 25 of the same card. You can send them out to all of your people. I do feel like I saw an uptick in companies that create the specialty card of, like, you can put all your family photos in there and do those things and kind of make a little scrapbook of your family. I mean, I've been threatening to do that. Like, here's me and my plants of this year. I've been threatening to do that for years. I haven't gotten around to it yet, but one of these years.
Maybe next year's the year, yeah.
Here's me and my plant, and I'll hold the plant like a child, and it'll just be really cute. A family portrait. It'll be good. All right. Well, Lauren Zimbuck, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us, business reporter at Chicago Tribune. And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet these stories out after the program so you can read them for yourself. Thanks for being with us, Lauren.
Thanks so much. Have a good one.
You too. All right, we're going to take a little break and come back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. So, it is the last Business Lunch show of 2018. That's what's happening. So, we're taking a look back, as many shows are wont to do, taking a look back at some of the big stories of the year. And as we look back on the business-specific stories, there is a great list CNN has that is really, really interesting. And they're kind of a lot of these lists come up from, like, okay, we're going to look at what we feel are the biggest stories, but also, like, what got the most shares, what got the biggest traffic online, what was tweeted the most, things like that. So there's many factors featuring into this. But one of them, of course, is a topic we've visited many times on the program, and that is the retail declines as Amazon has grown. And we've talked a lot about Amazon in many different ways, right? We've talked about some worker issues that have come up this year. We've talked about just the straight numbers that don't lie of, like, here's what people are doing. Here's what consumer behavior is and how it has shifted to really support more people are just shopping online. I mean, we saw that hit toy stores in the last couple of years too in a big way, which we talked about a lot.
And Jeff Bezos is now the richest man, not in the world, but ever. I mean, I guess that stands to reason.
Also the world, but also ever.
Yeah, is that right? Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, ever.
Yeah, he's very rich. So
I have been in a room with him before. And
really?
None of his wealth rubbed off on me. Like, I could, you know.
It's because you didn't ask.
I know. Could I like pat the back of your hand or something so that your money mojo comes to me? No, I should have.
Can I have $500,000?
Also, I could have just been like, hi, sir. I'm a creative person with lots of good ideas. I work in radio, which means very little money. So could I please have... I don't know.
I don't even think you need to give him a pitch. Just say, hey, can I have $500,000? That's like asking the time from somebody else. Like, do you have the time?
I'm sorry, do you have the time? Do you have change for a dollar for the parking meter? Right? You'd be like, here's $500,000. No problem. That's
why
fine.
Why not?
That's
why
right.
Not? Why don't you give it to me?
Yeah. And was it this year or this time last year? Or gosh, I don't know. Time flies so much. It was probably 6 years ago. I don't even remember. But it seems like about a year ago is when we were talking about his plan to start creating a space program so that he could supply cargo, like working in concert with Elon Musk's Mars program. He's like, I'm going to have cargo so you can Amazon Prime some, you know, junk to the Mars.
I actually, that got lost in the shuffle. That's one of the things, is that Amazon just stays in the news. They're constantly, because HQ2,
right. We talked about that a lot.
Which just finally found its kind of locations about a month ago. That's been an ongoing story for over a year. So that's, constantly provide us with some form of news, and cities vying for it. You know, Chicago was
certainly one of them.
Rahm was saying all these things that he would do, you know, the tax breaks and other incentives.
And I felt like I was the only person who was like, hey, can we talk about some of the downsides here?
Well,
and everybody was like, yay, Amazon. I was like, whoa, 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 traffic's bad enough, you guys. Hold on.
That's definitely part of it. And I think New York and is starting to... I think people are still still excited about it, but you see the full scope of what bringing a huge arm of Amazon to your city will mean when they have all these other things. That it's kind of like the Olympics conversation.
I was just going to say, it is exactly like that.
I mean, the benefits are more concrete, far more concrete in Amazon's case, or at least supposedly.
Yeah.
It's not just like, hey, attention for our city. That's a beautiful thing.
Whereas I feel like the...
Real jobs.
The downsides for the Olympics conversation were so much clearer.
Yeah, it is sort of similar, though. And I was thinking, well, the Whole Foods sale must have been this year, but that was actually well over a year ago.
Yeah, it was.
But that just flies, their extension into that branch of business, too, has been ongoing. And their effect on other companies that don't even do the same thing as them, but people expect Amazon fastness from any online purchase. So companies who have never been in that business at all feel that pressure, too.
Yeah. I was having that conversation with a friend of mine the other day about flowers, because she needed to send some flowers for, she was like, oh, it's, you know, it's somebody in my family. They're having a significant birthday. I need to send flowers. And she was like, I'm so trained by Amazon. It was unfathomable to me that I could not get a bouquet of flowers to a remote rural area in 24 hours. She was like, that freaked me out so much that I could Amazon Prime like a potholder to her, but not a bouquet of flowers.
Oh yeah. Businesses feel that big time and have to outsource to other companies that they don't want to do business with, but feel forced to. That's a whole thing going on.
Yeah. Too, so. I mean, I think in that regard, it's going to be, I think the delivery logistics game will be an interesting conversation in the year ahead.
Yeah.
Other big story this year was in the auto industry, and a lot of aspects of it too, both auto companies and manufacturers looking at the future of what, you know, as we're talking about self-driving cars and things like that. But that also kind of, there was a quick leap there to infrastructure conversations, because, you know, we talked about on the program, we were talking about traffic data, and the Tribune did a really interesting report about traffic data here in Chicago and what rideshare did to that. And suddenly, like, we've only got so much, and suddenly we're pouring, you know, a lot more, you know, a lot more cars out into the roads, and what that was looking at for, what that was looking like for travel, and just keeping up with infrastructure and keeping roads repaired and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, and GM, General Motors, cutting a lot of its staff and closing some big plants.
And that was a big talking point in Trump's narrative.
He slammed them when that happened, and because he kind of has a love-hate relationship with a lot of big companies that, where he prays until, and then, you know, something happens. It's just a volatile relationship he can have with big companies like that. And GM felt that this year, I think. And they are investing in like self-driving cars and electric cars and cutting a lot of its mainstay sedans and trucks too.
Yeah.
I'm in the future that they have a timetable where they'll phase out a lot of cars that we've known. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, I don't know. The future is what it is.
Yeah. We don't cover the Trump stuff as much, I think, on this show because I feel like that is a lot of the biggest business news, of course, involves him.
That's right.
But we're on Saturday.
We try to go easy on you guys. You've just heard politics all week. Like, give us an hour without politics.
Because, their number six story was Trump versus the Fed,
which was huge. I mean, we did talk a little bit about that.
It's hard not to touch it every once in a while.
And as like leadership changed at the Fed too, and there's a lot of conversation about interest rates and that kind of thing.
Number five, I know we talked about, was Elon Musk.
We've talked about him so many times. I don't know why. I always
It's fun.
Can't stop talking about him because he's just like so frustratingly fascinating in that you just want to shake him and go, like, you want to be his handler and just go, bro, stop.
Well, and
stop doing, don't help.
Looking at this top eight, you know, it's like you see things like, oh yeah, that was big, of course. And it's some of it's really frustrating and like very serious. And when you get to the top, we'll talk about that, I think, with other tech companies. But when you read his thing, it's like it's more fun than any of the other big stories of
the year. That's right.
Where he's slamming investors or he's slamming analysts on an investor call, gets in trouble for that. He smoked weed on Joe Rogan's podcast.
And just like generally erratic behavior. Like he was making appearances, just not acting.
Feuding with a diver that was saving those.
Oh my God. Those kids that were trapped in the cave in
Thailand.
He picked
a feud with one of the guys
saved
him.
He was so threatened. Like, I want to be the hero.
He wanted his technology in there.
Here's what it is. It's like the people that are so driven purely by ego are so fascinating to me because they're like a time bomb. They just cannot help themselves.
Yeah. And it's hard to, how could you have kept him from developing that ego? I mean, he's done
incredible things.
But it comes with some cost. And then the big one was pondering openly online about taking the company private. That's what turned things.
So many things.
The rest of it seemed a little more cosmetic. Like, yeah, that's embarrassing, but is it really going to hurt the company?
That's right.
When he had to
step down
as chairman, basically as a direct response.
Because there was a response, and that happened right before the show, because I think we talked about the response from the board Saturday morning, because it came out, I think they had to scramble late into the night on Friday to come up with this response after he did that on a Friday afternoon.
Whoops.
Yeah, whoops. That's not a good move. So number four was Wall Street's wild swings. We started the year pretty strong, and then big dives, and then big recoveries that happened pretty quickly. A really tough October, and a lot of trade fears and overseas instability. So we talked a lot about Wall Street this year.
Yeah, that's kind of tied to number three, which was
tariffs.
More just generally Trump's relationship with economic rivals in other countries.
Right.
So ripping up NAFTA and picking the fight that kind of ensued with Canada,
which is like you picked a fight with Canada. Come on.
And then of course the trade war with China was really
definitely
ongoing. You know, and we'll see what comes of that. It's hard to know.
Well, I think that's going to be really significant in the year ahead. I do, because that hits so much of the manufacturing sector, and it hits our products in really interesting ways. I mean, one of which is, as we talk about the shift in the news industry, even paper is a big part of that conversation. So I think that'll be...
And farmers were the ones feeling that.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot.
In the Midwest,
yes,
certainly.
We talked about that quite a bit when we're talking about, you know, crop trade and things like that.
Yeah, we did touch that one a little bit. And number two was the unemployment rate, which hit historic lows this year. It's been adding jobs for 98 months in a row.
I just want to like remind everybody that number is 98 months.
And then the counterbalance to that is our wages increasing. And the truth is slowly, much more slowly
ish
than jobs are actually growing.
Yeah.
Ish. And I think more recently you start to see that creep up a little bit.
We're still in a troubled moment, I think, with the gig economy. I was talking about that on the Saturday Night Special last weekend, because I was revisiting some of my favorite conversations in 2018. And that was one of them, of like the gig economy, what that really looks like in practical terms in our lives. And then the number one story of the year is all about Facebook. And I think we can all agree that was a very, very big story, from scandals that were, you know, sowing distrust in the tech industry, privacy, Zuckerberg's testimony on Capitol Hill, the biggest single day loss for any company. That is $119 billion with a B loss. That was really significant. Then the most recent story being that they allowed other tech giants like Spotify and Netflix to access private messages.
That was just like a week ago.
Yeah, it's still
all year,
going.
All
still
year.
Going. And a
I've
of,
heard it compared to the Mueller probe, which is like it's got multiple tentacles. You don't know which one to follow. Like,
that's absolutely true.
Facebook's in trouble for so much now.
It
clouds your brain. It's hard to know what to focus on.
That's right. And there was, you know, a lot of, I think, a very shifting narrative on Sheryl Sandberg, who for a while was kind of the reigning queen of lean in. We're doing the, like, this was women in the workplace. Like, she was kind of the leader, and she has really, you know, she became a very sympathetic character in a different way after her husband died. And she came up and said, hey, it's actually really hard to do this by yourself, and I've got a lot of money. And then now it's like, well, you got that money for maybe making some really questionable calls at Facebook. So the narrative around her has really shifted, and it's really been interesting. So.
And around Mark, too. Yeah, it's been a tough year for both of them.
Nobody likes that guy. I mean, there's been a lot of there was also like the documentary series that came about Facebook. A lot of people, like we saw the trending hashtag delete Facebook. A lot of people were just getting off of it completely. So I think it'll be really, really interesting to see what happens. There's some speculation that people are just going to be like, you know, to heck with Facebook. Let's just go all in on Instagram, which is a Facebook property. But who knows what the year ahead will bring. So that does it for now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We will see you back here next year, but we're going to check in with Scott Catoon and see what he's got coming up on the Startup Showcase here in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, as I said, that wraps it up for me for the year here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And it is now time to check in with our friend Scott Catoon and see what's happening on the Startup Showcase today. What's happening?
We have a great show today.
Tell me.
We're just going to ramble. I don't know. It's a typical
show. Those are sometimes the best shows where you're like, okay, all of my plans have fallen apart. I'm just going to talk.
It better be. That's my show every week.
The thing that I threaten anytime like a guest bails at the last minute or something, which happens time to time.
Oh, yeah.
I always threaten, I'm just going to list the contents of my handbag and we're going to talk about this. Somebody on social media recommend me a really awesome guest, or you're just going to hear about, like, this is a chewing gum wrapper. I acquired it at a Walgreens.
See, it took a long while to get to this point of, I mean, it took years to get to this point with Technori and just the shows and the podcast to where I can now legitimately say I can go through an inbox and fill an entire show reading really weird pitches. Like, there's enough, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's if I were to say to you, like, hey, send me an email about your crazy ideas, like, 2 years ago, it would have been, like, one email, maybe, if I'm lucky, and now there's hundreds of them of just loony pitches. So if we wanted to do the rest of this show, we could literally just read some of the crazy ideas, which leads to our show today.
Tell me.
Thomas Ma and Anish from Sapphire Apps. Thomas called into the show last week from L.A. This is how this works.
Okay.
Now he's here in studio. So Thomas is actually here with Anish in studio. Very cool. Thank you. So Thomas is actually in studio now. So he's calling in from LA last week. Now he's in studio. We're going to talk about all the things that we learned this last year as far as like entrepreneurship. They had a huge year. And I'll share more of it on the show. But Thomas is an interesting story. I think he pitched in front of me, man, 3 years ago with a company when he was at UIC, and now, you know, now he just bought a new Audi, so things are good. Life is good.
Did you say 3 years ago?
Yeah, something like that.
Wow, that's how long it's going to take, 3 years for an Audi.
It takes...
No, I was just thinking that. I was like, all right.
I can do this.
I can do this. I can... I'm going to get on the bus with my little...
I mean, I can steal an Audi.
I'm going to get on the bus on the way home, but in 3 years from now...
It took a while. It took a while, but it'll be a good show.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. I love how esteemed producer Griffin Filipich came in here and like handed you a note, and you were like, "Oh, okay, thanks, great." Like, it threw you off for a minute.
Oh yeah, I'm like, this is Bennett Wake Night, the famous Bennett Wake Night, is the perfect. He coined this for me. He said that my shows and podcasts are so utterly sporadic that as a producer, he just cannot even
he can't even
because he's like, you just stop as if like the world just paused for a moment. And I got a note, and I was like,
well,
oh, this
I
is
think
unpause.
It's like, because I feel like on some level you should be doing TV, not radio, because you're always like, oh, what is this? And you'll like,
oh, yeah.
You're visual in that way. Anyway, we're way over.
Yes, we are.
Jen DeSalvo is super waiting for us.
Okay, well, we will take it to the news here.